In this volume, Dr. Chopra reveals how the body has its own innate pharmacy. Consequently, it has an amazing ability to naturally create all of the healing agents that it needs. In order to initiate this phenomenon, however, it has to be in its natural balance. This inner balance can be created with the aid of our senses through sound, smell, touch, sight, and taste therapies. Dr. Chopra provides you with specific sound, smell, and touch therapies to aid you in creating harmonious body alignment. He gives additional information on the three doshas or body types and what each specifically require in order to create the balance necessary to produce the magical elements of its natural healing pharmacy.
I want to begin to introduce you to some Ayurvedic concepts that allow us to access the inner pharmacy. Our bodies, in fact, are wonderful pharmacies, and they make wonderful drugs. The human body can make everything: antibiotics, immunomodulators, tranquilizers, sleeping pills, you name it, the human body can make it in the right dose, at the right time, for the right organ. There are no side effects, and all the instructions come with the packaging. So we want to see how we can access that. And in order to do that, we have to understand some very simple, basic concepts that come from this great tradition of healing, which is known as Ayurveda. The word Ayurveda has two components to it: Ayus, which means life, and Veda, which means knowledge. So Ayurveda means knowledge of life. And according to Ayurveda, the human body is a microcosm of the universe. It's a hologram of the universe. We discussed that. And holographic descriptions are found not only in Ayurveda, but in all the traditions of the world. They are found in the insights of great visionary poets. William Blake, in one of his poems, says, "To see a world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, eternity in an hour." That's a holographic description of the universe. In Vedic literature, one comes across a little aphorism or sutra, and it says, "In Indra's heaven, there's a set of pearls so contained that if you pick up one of them, you'll see all of them." And then the sutra goes on to say, "This one is all." Again, a holographic description of the universe. A very basic aphorism in Ayurveda in Sanskrit is "Yatha pinde tatha brahmande," which means, as is the atom, so is the universe. As is the microcosm, so is the macrocosm. As is the human body, so is the cosmic body. As is the human mind, so is the cosmic mind. And if you don't like the word cosmic mind, you can call it a non-local field of information with self-referral cybernetic loops. And if you don't like the word soul, you can call it a continuum of probability amplitudes for space-time events in a field of infinite possibilities. But we're just relabeling everything, that's all. It's the same insights, and these are ancient insights. They have been part of the perennial philosophy and the spiritual tradition of every culture. They're not particularly unique to the East or to India. So all these philosophies, all these spiritual traditions have said more or less the same thing. Consciousness is the ultimate ground of creation, and as consciousness moves within itself, it conceives, governs, constructs, and becomes. Consciousness conceives, governs, constructs, and becomes the world of form and phenomenon. Consciousness by itself is a silent field of infinite possibilities. It is the potentiality for creation. It is the source of creation. the mind is the process of creativity. And the body and the universe are that which is created. But again, if you've understood all this, I've been saying the same thing in different ways. Observer, process of observation, and observe. Now I'm saying creator, process of creation, and created. They're all the same thing. So how does that mechanics occur? According to Ayurveda, consciousness, which is a field of infinite possibilities, and infinite bliss, and infinite silence, and infinite flexibility, and infinite creativity, it gets restless. It begins to move within itself. And as it begins to move within itself, then the disturbance in consciousness, it creates, out of the silence, it creates sound. The sound is the first manifestation of consciousness. And this sound is called primordial sound. Why? Because it is primordial. It's right in the beginning. You've heard the expression, in the beginning there was the Word, and the Word was made into flesh. But what's the Word? A word is a sound in consciousness. It's a disturbance in the silence, as the silence interacts within its own self. The primordial sound has two components to it, and in Sanskrit, in ancient Sanskrit, these two components are known as Shruti and Smriti. The word Shruti means that which is heard. You hear words, you hear sounds in your consciousness. Smriti, that which is remembered. If I hear the word mother in my consciousness, there are two components to it. Mother, which is a sound, and then the meaning in that sound. Mother has a meaning, the memory of that sound. So Shruti is that which is heard, Smriti is that which is remembered. And every word that is heard in consciousness has those two components, the sound and the memory. The sound is energy and the memory is information. And I already said that consciousness manifests through two components, energy and information. And every sound that we hear as word in our consciousness, in any language, has common origins, which means linguistically structured, verbally elite thought is a very late evolutionary development in the human nervous system. In its primordial state, all thought is just Shruti and Smriti, sound and meaning, memory. And as you trace the roots of words in different languages, irrespective of what the language is, as you trace the roots of words in different languages, which a certain category of scientists does, that category of scientists is known as a paleolinguistic anthropologist. Paleolinguistic anthropologists study the origins of words. They find that all words come from common sounds. And these sounds, in a sense, are the roots of these words. And the roots are common to all languages. I just used the word mother right now. Mother in Hindi, in Indian language, is Mata. In Latin, it is mater. In Greek, it's matrix. But it's also the origin of words like meter, music, time, measurement, matrika, which means the mother of the alphabet. So you see, that same word is giving rise, that same sound is giving rise to so many different words that are all related. They all relate to the one idea, womb, the womb of creation. Similarly, if you look at divine in Sanskrit or Hindi, it's deva or devata. But it also is the origin of the word diabolical or devil. The devil is just the divine that's ill, not feeling well. Devil, right? Pleasure, pain, cold, khalda, scalding, hot, they're all related. The origins of words are sounds that encompass the poles of opposite of meaning. And it's the poles of opposite of meaning that make life a experience by contrast. Because if there wasn't contrast, there wouldn't be any experience. Consciousness by itself, the source, the creator, being everything, is a field of, in a sense, everything, but only in potentiality, before the creation. And once creation starts occurring, then you have these poles of opposite created. Light and darkness, up and down, hot and cold, pleasure and pain, divine and diabolical, etc. That's what makes life meaningful. So sound is the first manifestation in consciousness. The second manifestation of creativity is when sound gets precipitated into form. Sound gets precipitated into form. The vibration or the frequency freezes into matter. Incidentally, even the word matter has the same origin as mother. Matter, matrix, matra, matrika. Matter comes from the same place, as the same womb of creation. So when sound gets precipitated into matter, and we know that it does, the word becomes the flesh, the thought becomes the neuropeptide, then we experience that as emotion. We experience sound as thought. I had this thought. We always say, I had this thought. But actually, it would be truer to say, I heard the thought. We hear it. When we say emotion, we don't say, I had the thought. What do we say? I felt the emotion. Why do we feel the emotion? Because now, it's not just a sound in consciousness. It's a feeling in the body. It's a sensation in the body. And being a sensation in the body, it's a molecule in the body as well. The word has become the flesh. A thought is linked to a sensation. And when the thought and the sensation are together, that's an emotion. I have the thought, I felt the emotion. So out of sound comes touch. Why? Because you feel this. It's a feeling of touching. You touch your emotions. In fact, when we refer to our emotions, that's what we say. I was so touched by what you said. We are touched somewhere, internally. Out of sound and touch and the friction that creates internally in the world of consciousness is generated fire or light. And that's the third code of intelligence, sight. I had the thought, mother, I felt the emotion, and then I closed my eyes and I saw my mother. What is that image that you see? You can close your eyes right now and you can think the word mother. If you want, if you introduce the intention, you can see her. Where is that image? What is that image? That image is the spark of fire in your consciousness. And it's actually a visual experience on the holographic template of your own memory plate in that field of infinite possibilities. So the third code of intelligence is sight of fire. The combination of sound, touch, sight creates the experience of taste, the fourth code of intelligence. And the combination of sound, touch, sight, taste creates the experience of smell, the fifth code of intelligence. In other words, sound, touch, sight, taste, and smell, in that order, represent the sequential unfoldment of consciousness, of intelligence, as it interacts with its own self and manifests as form and phenomenon. These are codes of intelligence. And then sound is experienced objectively or projects itself objectively as space. Touch projects itself objectively as air. Sight projects itself objectively as light, as fire. Taste projects itself objectively as water. Smell projects itself objectively as earth. In other words, space, air, fire, water, and earth are the objective manifestations of these codes of intelligence that emerge from consciousness as it reverberates and vibrates within itself. And these are the five elements. In Sanskrit, they're called the Mahabhutas, the five great elements. And the codes of intelligence are called the Tanmatras, those disturbances in consciousness that create everything. Tonight we're going to talk about the doors of perception and how our senses, our sensory experience, can influence the healing process. A little background on that. Ayurveda is a consciousness-based medicine, which means that all the material expressions that we've been learning about, now we've been learning about vata, pitta, kapha, everything that we do in terms of the physical body, the understanding of that is consciousness-based, because the physical body is just the expression of consciousness. The physical body is just a bundle of consciousness. What is consciousness? It's energy and information which is self-referral. Therefore, it's intelligence. And so, one of the things that I hope will happen with you, because it happened with me as I started to explore this, is that after a while, you don't even mentally think of the body as physical. Now, you think of the body as this bundle of consciousness, always. Start to look at it, start to think about it, start to examine it in your own awareness as a bundle of consciousness, which is constantly and ever in dynamic exchange with the universe, which is the ocean of consciousness. And there is this dynamic dance going on between your body and the universe all the time. And it's constantly transforming. Think in your mind that it's infinitely flexible. Because consciousness is infinitely flexible. So in your mind, have that idea always that the physical body is not physical. Even though it appears to be physical, it's not physical. It's a bundle of consciousness, and consciousness in its very nature is infinitely flexible. There's a Vedic expression, infinite flexibility is the secret of immortality. Don't forget that. Infinite flexibility in consciousness. And of course, yoga tries to culture that infinite flexibility in the physical body, but ultimately the body is not physical. So think about the infinite flexibility of consciousness. And the physical body just is an expression of that. When I see people, you know, somebody comes up to me and says, will you sign this book? Or, hello, how are you? It's almost automatic with me that I immediately, in my mind, you know, wonder, vata, pitta, kapha, vata. What combination? It's just automatic. So do that. You know, when I started learning Ayurveda, I used to sit with an Ayurvedic physician on the beach, and everybody that passed by would say, okay, now tell me. And you know, and we would just look at people just walking by, and in our minds, vata, pitta, kapha. And after a while, he would say, okay, now tell me what they're thinking. And you will be able to do that. Just pay attention to that. Because, you know, there's a certain pattern that goes with vata, a certain pattern that goes with pitta, a certain pattern that goes with kapha, a certain kind of bodily movement, there's a certain kind of eye gesture, there's a certain kind of hand movement. But you'll be able to do that. But the first thing is, think that the body is a bundle of consciousness.
then think. When you encounter people, start thinking. What is that consciousness's expression in terms of these three factors that we have learnt now about? And remember those three factors basically as movement, as transformation, as structure. Those are the three principles in creation, in all of creation. So, movement, transformation, structure. Whenever movement is exaggerated, that's vata is expressing itself. Whenever there's transformation, that's pitta expressing itself. And then there's structure, stability, that's kapha expressing itself. Those are the three principles through which consciousness operates. And third, when you look at people, and it becomes habit after a while. Just go beyond what you're seeing. First you're seeing their physical body, then you're seeing their movements, their gestures, their speech. But there's a soul over there. Look at that. Look, feel the presence of the soul and the spirit, the animating life force. Here's somebody speaking to you. Ask yourself, who's speaking to me? Now, this is just the instrument of speech. This vocal cord is just the instrument of speech. These hand gestures are instruments. There's a presence there. There's a spirit there. So go look for it. Feel it. You start connecting with that. Also, when you look at someone, when you interact with someone, and I've started doing this only recently myself, but I'm telling you it's very important to do because it really connects you to other people. Is as soon as you encounter someone or if you're having an interaction with someone, deep inside your own self, just say, there's a soul there, there's a spirit here, and we are both equal. There's no one who's superior, there's no one who's inferior. On the level of spirit, we are coming as equals. And if you just acknowledge that inside you, you'll connect with that soul. You'll connect with that soul. Okay, so we started all our lives, you know, this present life that we have, we all started off as a little speck of information on DNA. That's what the material expression of soul is. It comes into this physical manifest world as a speck of information that has this little DNA in it. And then people start adding food to it, and then suddenly we have this physical body that goes around doing things, signing books and lectures and giving speeches. Essentially, consciousness manifests as a speck of information on DNA, and that speck of information keeps transforming itself. We are a dynamic bundle of information that's continuously and ever in transformation. And that transformation is brought about through experience. So, whatever is happening in our body is that original speck of information that was the soul's way of coming here with its karma, its memories and its desires. And then that transformation starts through experience. And we start to metabolize experience. You know, in medical school we were taught to metabolize food. Well, that's not the only thing we metabolize. We metabolize experience. Food is one of the experiences that we metabolize. And our physical body is nothing other than the metabolic end product of experiences. And there's a Vedic expression also for that. It says, if you want to know what your experiences were like in the past, then you can examine your body now. And if you want to know what your body will look like in the future, then you can examine your experiences now. You want to change your body, change your experience of life. You want to change the outcome of an illness, change experience. It's very important to understand that. We don't do that when we treat people. You know, we look at the disease and then we treat the disease. We interfere with the mechanism of the disease. But we never say to ourselves, You know, this disease came about as a result of experiences that were metabolized into this unhealthy expression. So if we want to reverse this illness, and then the whole concept of reversal doesn't even exist in modern medicine until recently, and we'll talk about heart disease, where there's for the first time some good insight that heart disease, and I'm talking about coronary artery disease, but coronary artery disease is now proven to be reversible. And just that has started a whole new kind of paradigm, in a sense, in modern medicine, not in Ayurveda. Ayurveda holds that diseases are reversible. Because if there's a mechanism for it, then there's a mechanism in the reverse direction for it. Everything has its opposite. So one of our principles of spirit, for everything that exists, has the opposite also. So there is reversibility of disease in the disease itself is the potentiality for complete balance and health. But that concept only recently appeared in Western medicine when people started documenting through angiography that coronary artery disease is reversible, and we will be talking about that. But what is even more important is that paradigm now is saying to us, well, if coronary artery disease is reversible, why not rheumatoid arthritis? Why not cancer? Why not multiple sclerosis? There's a mechanism, there should be a mechanism in the reverse direction. So that's a great breakthrough, just a fact that people have documented that coronary artery disease is reversible. Consciousness being a field of infinite flexibility, that for everything that exists and has a mechanism, there's a mechanism in the reverse direction. Start thinking like that. And what that mechanism is, it has to do with how we metabolize our experiences. And how do we, therefore, the next question is, how do we get experience? And in the physical world, of course, there are three levels of experience. There are experiences in the flesh, in the material body, the experiences in the world of emotion, and then there are experiences in the world of spirit. So in order to be truly holistic, we need to include all these three levels. Actually, we need to include four levels. The environment, the physical body, the subtle body, and the causal body. And we discussed these levels. So, first of all, the environment has to be healing. And what's the one thing you think that would be the most dangerous experience that would interfere with healing? Fear. What's the one thing that you think would be the most conducive to healing? Love. So those are the opposites, right? The opposite of fear is not hate. Hate is a desperate cry for love, actually. Every act of violence and every expression of hate is a desperate cry for love. The opposite of love is fear. So what happens when you go to a hospital? What's the first experience you have? You feel afraid, yes. I mean, this is the tragedy that we have created environments where people are supposed to go to get healed, and the first experience they have as soon as they enter is fear. I mean, the hospital next to a prison is the most fearful place. Literally. And that's unfortunate that we have created that experience. It's not a healing environment. It's not a healing environment. You know, everything from simple things like the way the beepers work, to the way the code 99s work, the code red works, the way the sirens work, the uniforms, the machines, everything creates intimidation. So, if any of you is ever going to be practicing, the first thing you have to do is you have to create an environment that is nurturing, that is nourishing, that gives a person the feeling that there is the energy of love here, real energy of love. So, when you're encountering a patient and you're going to do body work on them, in your mind, just that little attitude that I am with the physical expression of divinity here, that will just create a quality in the environment that will take away the fear. Because most of our experiences are actually non-verbal. You don't have to say anything to a person. You remember the famous expression of Emerson? He says, "Who you are shouts so loudly in my ears, I cannot hear what you're saying." You don't have to say anything. If that's the inner attitude, it will be reflected in the way you touch the patient, in the way you interact with the patient, in the way you massage, in the way you do anything. So the first ingredient is creating that healing environment. So in this section, what we are going to deal with is enhancing sensory perception. Also the idea that we can use our perception and our experiences through the five senses to create balance inside the body. I'd like to go back to the basic notion that our body is part of the body of the universe. That basic expression, as is the atom, so is the universe. As is the human body, so is the cosmic body. And everything that happens in the universe ultimately results in what we can call biological rhythms in the body. So as the earth moves on its own axis, we have the cycle of night and day, which results in very profound changes in our physiology. As the earth moves around the sun, the cycles of the seasons, the tides cause ebb and flow in our physiology. Even the relationship of the sun, earth and moon, as they move in relation to each other, results in biological cycles in us. 28-day cycles. The human menstrual cycle is a good example of that, but there are many other 28-day cycles. You can give an animal a certain dose of radiation at 4 o'clock in the morning, it may kill him. You give the same dose of radiation at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it may have a beneficial effect. The reason is the body has completely changed in that 12-hour period. So the body is always changing, and it is trying to synchronize its rhythms with the rhythms of the universe. So the signal that comes to us when we are out of harmony with the universal rhythm is the sense of discomfort, whether it's physical, emotional, intellectual. So all techniques that we're going to talk about now are to resynchronize the body's rhythms with the rhythms of the universe. And we do that through our five senses also. What is sensory experience other than taking in information from the universe and then matching it with the information inside this universe, which is my body? My body is a whole universe within itself. And sensory experience is just taking information from the universe outside my skin into the universe inside my skin and matching intelligence with intelligence. So let's start with sound. If we understand the quantum mechanical framework well, then we realize that the body is in fact nothing other than vibration. Vibrations in the unified field which result in the molecules that make up the body. So the body is ultimately just vibration. And the vibration of the body has to match the vibrations that make up the universe. And this matching or locking in or falling into a rhythmic relationship with, it's called entrainment. E-N-T-R-A-I-N-M-E-N-T. To entrain with means to establish a rhythmic relationship with something. Entrainment was first described by a physicist named Ichak Bentov. He did a very interesting experiment with clocks. He had five clocks. Each of them had a pendulum about the same size. He started the pendulums swinging at different times, not synchronously. But when he waited for about 4 hours or so, then what happened was the penduli gradually started swinging to the same rhythm. You can do this experiment any number of times and you'll find that even though you start the pendulums swinging at different times, after a while they all start swinging to the same rhythm. And this phenomenon is called entrainment, falling into rhythmic relationship with each other. I'll give you another example of it. You take a baby and put it next to its mother's breast. After a while, the baby's heart rate will entrain with the mother's heart rate. In other words, there'll be a rhythmic relationship between the two. It may not be the same rate, but there's a relationship. The baby's breathing will entrain with the mother's breathing also. And in fact, when you agree with somebody or disagree with somebody, what's happening is entrainment or falling out of entrainment. When I agree with you, because my thoughts are stimulating the same quantum fields in my awareness, then my breathing spontaneously matches your breathing, and so on. If you have a lot of women living together, you'll find that after a while, their menstrual cycles will entrain with each other. They'll all have their menstrual periods about the same time. So entrainment is a universal phenomenon, and it begins at the moment of conception. A baby's rhythms start entraining with cosmic rhythms through the physiology of the mother. And then they keep doing that right through pregnancy, and then even after the baby is born, it needs the proximity to its mother to have this entrainment continue. And the entrainment is through all the five senses. We can take any one of the senses and see how that happens. For example, sound can entrain our body's rhythms with universal rhythms. Music can do that also. Now, in the last few years, there's been a lot of research on this. It's become obvious that music can influence the heart rate of a person, brain waves, blood pressure, stomach contractions, levels of hormones that are associated with stress, with immunity, can be influenced through music. Also, there are secretions in our body known as endorphins, which are the body's natural opiates, which means the body's natural morphine-like compounds that are secreted when we listen to music that we enjoy. And therefore, when we are enjoying a certain piece of music, actually there are certain chemical changes occurring in the body. In fact, you can block the pleasure of music that a person gets by giving them an injection of something called Narcan, which is a narcotic antagonist. Which means that when we are listening to music and enjoying it, then in fact we are generating some very powerful chemical messengers, the neuropeptides. And these are healing chemicals, they're the body's pharmacy. In the last few years, there's been some research which shows that different kinds of music will have different kinds of effects on the body. For example, high-pitched music will create a playful and happy mood, but also will speed up the metabolism. So high-pitched music, for example, would therefore be much more appropriate for a kapha type, because the kapha body type is hypometabolic, slow. If he hears high-pitched music, or if he hears music that has faster rhythm to it, that will increase his metabolism. On the other hand, low-pitched music slows down the body's metabolism. So it would be very useful, for example, in a vata type of person, to listen to a low-pitched music, also to music which has a slower rhythm to it. So slow and quiet music will bring about changes in the body that are the opposite of a hypermetabolic status. It's also been found, for example, that music played in post-surgical patients after surgery will decrease the need for pain medicines or for tranquilizers and also hasten the recovery of a patient after surgery. And now music therapy is standardly used in various clinics to treat depression, migraine, anxiety, isolation and burn victims, also treatment of post-coronary patients, organ transplant patients, also after heart attacks. So this is already becoming standard therapy. The second thing is that all our experiences in the physical body are through our senses. So sensory stimulus is traditionally seen in Ayurveda as the key to healing. We approach the inner pharmacy through the senses. The senses are the gateway to the inner pharmacy. So Ayurveda has always held that there are two kinds of pharmacies in the universe. One is our physical body, which is a pharmacy by itself. And then the second pharmacy is the world of plants. The world of plants and to some extent the world of minerals. Because the world of plants is also the physical body of spirit. And that's why all the herbal pharmacopoeia of Ayurveda, which you'll hear a lot about, is very profound. There's at least over 1,000 different herbal preparations with very clear, distinctive effects on the human body. And you'll learn about this. At least you'll get a good introduction to it. Modern science is showing that the human body creates homeostasis or healing. We have a healing system in us actually through powerful endogenous pharmacological products. So the human body makes some of the most significant wonder drugs that are available today. The so-called best drugs, the most effective, powerful drugs that modern medicine makes are called biologicals. And these biologicals are things like interferon, interleukins, other immunomodulators. So these are powerful anti-cancer drugs. The body makes imipramine, which is an antidepressant. The body makes all kinds of neuropeptides, which are very powerful drugs, literally. H2 receptor blockers, you name it, the human body can make it. It makes it at the right time when we are in the state of balance. Makes it at the right time, in the right dose, and no side effects, and all the instructions are contained in the packaging. So the body has evolved over literally millions of years to this bundle of consciousness with formidable intelligence. In fact, the best drugs that the pharmaceutical industry is now getting a handle on, including receptor blockers, are made by the human body. And how does the body make them? In response to sensory stimulation. In response to stimulation through the five senses. It makes them in response to what's going on in our inner world of thought and feeling and emotion and desire and memory. That's a whole different area. But at this moment, I'm only talking about the physical body and the pharmacy in the physical body that responds to sensory stimulation. True healing can only happen when there's perfect alignment of elements and forces in the human body with elements and forces in the cosmic body. When there is perfect alignment, or we might say harmonious interaction of elements and forces in the physical body with the cosmic body. And this alignment, atonement, at-one-ment, coherence, entrainment, is what we are trying to achieve whenever we are bringing about the healing process. Because when we are totally tuned in to the cosmic rhythm, if you will, then the intelligence of nature flows through us with spontaneous and effortless ease. That's what we want, this effortless spontaneity of nature's intelligence flowing through our physical body. So one of the first most important things is also understanding of biological rhythms. We have a whole lecture on that, and we'll discuss biological rhythms and restoration of biological rhythms. But that is an important ingredient. The rhythms of the cosmos and the rhythms of the microcosm must be in alignment with each other. It's very important in treating cancer, and very important in treating actually any chronic illness. So through sensory experience, that's also what we're trying to achieve, this restoration of biological rhythm. And this process, as I said, there are many names for it: at-one-ment, coherence, entrainment. Entrainment is a word that's frequently used. And entrainment, or this tendency for physical bodies to tune in with other physical bodies, is a well-known phenomenon in nature. Because one of the principles, again, of spirit, I mentioned one, everything contains its opposite. But there's another principle from last night, everything is vibration. And vibration tends to tune in to similar vibration. And this quality is called resonance. So any object in the universe, any object, has a certain vibration at which it resonates. And it begins first through sound. Because sound is vibration. Right now the sound I'm producing is the vibration of breath and therefore the vibration of atmosphere. In fact, there are references to the effect of sound in all the religious and spiritual traditions of the world. In the New Testament, you will read the phrase where the Roman centurion says to Christ, he says, "Lord, I'm not worthy that thou should come under my roof, but say the word, speak the sound, and my soul shall be healed." And of course, in the Gospel of John, first there was the word was made into flesh. In Vedic literature, Nada Brahman, which says, Brahman creates through sound, through vibration. And in fact, there's a reference in the New Testament, according to Luke, where the mother of John the Baptist, when she sees the Virgin Mary and she's pregnant with John the Baptist, she says, "The babe in my womb leaped with joy when it heard the sound of your voice." We begin to respond to sound even before we are born, and we respond to the sounds of the mother's body, her, what she hears, all the sounds she makes, what she speaks, the sounds in the environment. But even after we are born, we are constantly influenced by sound. In fact, the whole basis of Ayurveda is that we start out as pure consciousness, which is a field of infinite possibilities, which is pure silence. And then that silence, the pure consciousness, which is the field of infinite possibilities, silence, it interacts with its own self. And as it interacts with its own self, it begins to vibrate. And when it begins to vibrate, it produces sound. And sound, therefore, is the way consciousness becomes conscious. Our intelligence becomes intelligent. And a thought is nothing other than a sound in your consciousness. It's a vibration in that silence. And the thought is the final expression of what is called primordial sound, the first elemental vibrations in consciousness. And these elemental vibrations in consciousness are universal. They are not just human. They are the origins of language. So there are scientists that are called paleolinguistic anthropologists who study the origins of language, and paleolinguistic anthropologists inform us that as we look at the origins of language, no matter what the language is, Eastern, French, English, Latin, Sanskrit, Indo-Aryan languages, Chinese, as we start to go to their roots, we find the same sounds. These are the sounds of nature. Nature speaks in order to create. So first there was the word was made into flesh, is literal. Language is not a way of describing things. Language is a way of creating things. You create through language. You do not describe. You create through language. In fact, there is no thing that exists that doesn't have a word. If it doesn't have a word, it's not part of your experience. Even if it exists, if there's no word for it, it will not be part of your perceptual experience. Language creates. Remember that. So these sounds, universal sounds, are called primordial sounds. Primordial sounds have been used traditionally for healing in all the cultures of the world to bring about entrainment, remove the dissonant vibrations from the body and introduce the vibratory frequencies that bring about entrainment. And there are many kinds of primordial sounds. The first kind of primordial sound is the sound of the alphabet itself. The alphabet, which is universal, if you sound it out, whether it doesn't matter if you sound out the alphabet in English or in Greek or in Latin or in Hindi or in Sanskrit, the sound of the alphabet is the same. In fact, the word for the sounds of the alphabet in Sanskrit is Matrika, which means the mother of language. And there are two categories of primordial sounds in language, the vowels and the consonants. And the vowels are, of course, A, E, I, O, U in English. In Sanskrit, A, E, E, U, U, A, I, O, U, Aha. You don't have to remember that. Just remember A, E, I, O, U. So right now I want to take you through a couple of little techniques that you can incorporate into your healing repertoire. Okay, and these have to do with using the sounds of the alphabet. The first sound is A. Okay, take a deep breath. And as you exhale, make the sound A. Okay, now we'll do it once again. This time we'll make it really loudly and we'll keep saying it till we run out of breath. By the way, this is a great pranayama, it's a great breathing exercise too. So take a deep breath again, and this time as you're making it, close your eyes and feel your body. Feel the vibrations. Introduce the sound into your body, the vibration into your body. This time, what we're going to do is, as we make the sound, we close the eyes, we'll mentally have attention on some part of the body. And we'll have the intention for healing. Now, this is very subtle. What I mean, attention on some part of the body, just put your, very effortlessly put your attention on that part of the body. It's not a concentration. Okay? Wiggle your toes, please. That's attention and intention, right there. As soon as you did that, your attention went to your toes, and then you have the intention, wiggling. So it's so simple that it hardly needs explanation. You don't think, heal, heal, heal. Okay? Because that's too mental. Too mental. We want to work from the level of spirit. So this time when you make the sound, just put your attention on some part of the body where you want healing to occur. And then don't think healing, healing, healing. The attention is there and the intention is implied. Okay? The more subtle, the better. Just like when you wiggle your toes, you don't say wiggle, wiggle, wiggle. Okay? You just do it. You have the intention. So this time, put your attention on some part of your body that you want healing to occur. And if you can't decide where to do that because you're already healed, put it on your heart. We all need some emotional healing. Okay, this is a great place to put your attention on because the heart is not just a pump, it's the seat of emotions as well. So choose a spot in your body and this time close your eyes and make that sound with the attention and intention going to the part of the body. Okay, now the same thing, whichever part you chose, choose that same part again. Let's say you directed the sound to your heart, or if you have a neck spasm and you directed it there, or whatever, you have an ulcer, you directed it to your stomach. Stay with that, and this time we'll do the same process with the sound A. Okay? Instead of saying ah, we say A. A. Sound of the letter E. Again, take a deep breath. E. And now we'll use the sound of the letter O. O. Remember, each time we're directing it to that same part of the body with the attention and intention for healing and transformation. Now, the sound of the letter U. U. Okay, what I'd like you to do is, for the next few days, when you're in the bathroom or taking a walk, try these five sounds. A, A, E, O, U. And keep directing them to one part and then another part and then another part. And in a few days, decide which one of these five sounds, A, A, E, O, U, feels good inside your body. Which one of these creates a feeling of energy? Which one of these creates a vibration where you direct it? You know, if you're directing it to your solar plexus, do you feel some sensation there? Do you feel some vibration? If you direct it to your heart, do you feel some resonance there? Do you feel some vibration there? So try each one of these and see which one feels more energizing, which one is easy to direct, which one creates sensation, vibration, and then choose that, adopt it, make it your personal primordial sound of the alphabet. And then practice with that, directing it to different parts of the body with the intention of healing. Once you've done that for a few days, then no longer make the sound. Close your eyes and hear the sound in your consciousness, in the subtle body. So now let's do that for a moment. What we'll do is, we'll take these same sounds and just close your eyes, and when I say start, then start with the sound ah and direct it to some part of your body, hearing it now. So again, close your eyes and listen to the sound, ah, the way we were doing it, and direct it to some part of your body. And now do that with A. And with E. And with O. And with who. Please open your eyes. So, within a few days or a few weeks, what you should be able to experience is that you can sit down any time during the day, and for a minute or 2 minutes, you can take one of these sounds. Don't try all of them. You know, you need to adopt one and become just proficient at using that one. So, out of these five, just use one. Then start mentally directing the sound to different parts of the body with that attention and intention of healing. So let's say your heart is speeding up and you want to slow it down, as in somebody who has tachycardia, you can actually break an arrhythmia with this, just by doing this. So one of the things that you can combine it with is the experience of smell. This process is called neuroassociative conditioning. You train your nervous system to associate one sensory experience with another sensory experience. I'll discuss how smell works in a few minutes. But for now, if you, let's say, combine a smell with the ability to mentally direct a sound. And how do you do that? Well, let's say you're directing the sound to your heart, mentally, okay? And you want to slow it down. I'm just using that right now as the example. Now, what you would want to do is direct mentally the sound to your heart, and at the same time, you would take a vata balancing smell, because speeding up of the heart is a vata problem, right? It's too much movement. You would take a vata balancing smell and you would smell it as you're mentally directing that sound. And after a while, what would happen is your limbic system will, every time it smells that, it would automatically associate with that sound and automatically associate it with the intention of slowing the heart rate down. So after a while, you wouldn't even have to think the whole process. You could take just the smell, and smell it, and you'd slow the heart rate down. Or let's say the problem is an ulcer, you do the same thing. You're directing the sound there, whatever the sound is, ooh. You're directing the sound there mentally, but at the same time you're smelling something with the ulcer. What kind of a problem is an ulcer? Pitta. So you're taking a cooling smell, which is pitta balancing at the same time. So after a while, then every time you smell that, the ulcer will cool down, etc., etc. This is called neuroassociative conditioning. Okay, so that's how we use the sounds of the vowels. And remember, choose one, not all. Then there are other sounds which are not the vowels, the consonants, which spontaneously tend to localize in different parts of the body. And we'll just take a few examples of them. The vowel sounds are the most useful. The reason being, you can easily direct them anywhere in the body. The non-vowels are not so useful because they have a tendency to localize. So let's go over some of them, the most useful ones. The first sound is the sound of the letter N or N. So your tongue is touching the back of your teeth and you take a deep breath and you exhale making the sound. N. do it right, you should feel a vibration in your mastoid process. Take your index finger, put it on your mastoid as you do it and see if you can feel the vibration. Can you feel the vibration there? Okay, this sound is traditionally directed to this area. It improves bone conduction. One of the problems as we grow older is that we don't hear as well. So this is very good sound for improving your bone conduction and hearing. It's also very good if you have tinnitus, which is ringing in the ears. It's also good if you have vertigo. The origin of the vertigo is some imbalance in the inner ear. Okay, because it tends to align those three little bones that are responsible for bone conduction. The sound of the letter M, ma. You should feel the vibration in your sinuses. It improves, or it is good for those people who tend to have periodic congestion of the sinuses, kapha problems in the sinuses. Direct the sound here. The sound of ka, ga, gha, ka, ga, gha comes directly from the vocal cords. So let's try it. Ka, ga, gha, ka, ga, gha, ka, ga, gha. Now, one of the problems, again, as we grow older, one of the things that happens is that our vocal cords lose their elasticity. They're not so resilient anymore. But if you practice the sound, you'll keep the resilience here. And actually, I've taught the sound to a lot of professional singers. And they practice it every day. It is very good to keep your voice young, resonant, keep the resilience of the vocal cords. Actually, every sound of the alphabet has a localized expression in the body. One of them is very useful, and that is the sound of the letter H, also known as, in Sanskrit, called Mahaprana, which means big breath. You know how people clean their glasses sometimes? So with your mouth open, make that sound. Okay, take a deep breath with your mouth open. Okay, now close your mouth and breathe in through the nose and breathe out through the nose with the intention of producing that sound. You just have to squeeze the back of your throat a little bit. Okay, now, let me tell you something very interesting about this sound. It has some amazing physiological effects. First of all, if you have someone practice this breathing, which is called ujjayi breathing, making the sound, and at the same time have them have their hands in this position. This is a classic mudra. Mudra is a fixed position of the hand. So you're three fingers here are extended, and your forefinger and your thumb are opposing each other like this. Okay, so just you're sitting on a chair, you put your hands on your lap, and you practice ujjayi breathing. And if I have you behind the fluoroscope is an X-ray machine, and I'm watching your breathing, what I'll notice is that your breathing is predominantly diaphragmatic. In fact, you can't do this mudra and breathe this way without moving your diaphragm very significantly. Try. It's just when you breathe in, your stomach goes out because the diaphragm goes down. When you breathe out, the diaphragm goes up and the stomach goes in. It is the way to use diaphragmatic breathing. So, one of the nerves that comes to the diaphragm is called the vagus nerve. which also goes to the heart. And when you do this breathing, the vagus nerve gets stimulated and your heart starts to slow down. This is one of the most effective ways of lowering blood pressure, of slowing the heart rate. It's better than a beta blocker, literally. And I'll tell you some other uses for this in a moment. But this is one of the things that it does. Okay, so it slows down the heart rate, it lowers the blood pressure. Now, over the years, I have personally taught this breathing to athletes, actually to some Olympic athletes. But one of the things I've done over the years with trainers, professional trainers, is teach this breathing to athletes when they're running or when they're doing some physical exercise. Honestly, I'm not exaggerating. I have marathon runners who have the same heart rate at the end of the run as at the beginning of the run. Because even as they're running, they control their heart rate through this breathing. And what this does is, because it lowers your heart rate at the same time increasing your breathing capacity, because the diaphragm is moving up and down like this, it also increases your cardiac output. And as a result of that, it increases your coronary blood flow. It is quite amazing, the improvement in athletic performance, you know, for people who could run 5 miles, run 10 miles. And their breathing is slow. Even the end of the run, they're breathing at 18 per minute, 14 to 18 per minute, at the end of the run. And their heart rate doesn't go up. Or if it goes up, you know, at maximum heart rate, it'll go up 100, 110, and 2 minutes after the run is over, it'll be back to 70. So it's a great way to increase exercise performance, a great way to increase cardiac output, a great way to lower blood pressure, a great way to increase breathing capacity, therefore to energize yourself, to immediately feel invigorated. Mahaprana, the sound, you should be able to hear the sound as you're doing it. And this sound also can be used to abort an asthmatic attack, a breathing bronchospasm. As soon as you begin to notice that you're having bronchospasm, start practicing ujjayi breathing. In yoga, it's called the sound of the letter H. Mahaprana is the sound of the letter H. So this is the first category of primordial sounds. The second category of primordial sounds are the sounds of nature. Because, remember, even our speech is an expression of primordial sound. Language, in its linguistic, verbally elite expression, is a very late development in evolution. All of nature is full of language. Birds sing. Why? Because that's nature singing in the morning. Crickets make sounds at night. That's nature's sound at night. So any sound in nature, whether it's the sound of a waterfall or a sound that's recurring, like cricket sings at night every day, birds sing in the morning every day, the ocean has its sound throughout the day, a different sound as it goes through the tidal rhythms. These are healing sounds. All sounds of nature are healing sounds. So they are primordial. Overtone chanting is using the same sounds of the alphabet, but with overtones in it. Tibetans have mastered the overtone chanting, and also Gregorian chanting is sometimes a modified form of overtone chanting. So mantra chanting. Mantras have amazing effects on the physiology. Mantras are not random sounds, and the fact is that there are some initial studies now that show you can take cells out of the body and put them in a test tube. Take some lymphocytes and white cells and put them in a test tube and play mantras to them. And you'll find that they start secreting immunomodulators like interleukin, interferon, etc. Now that's in response to mantra, but cells respond in vitro, in the test tube, to other sounds as well, to music. So if you play music that produces tranquility, and you know, music of course is a cultural thing many times. You associate certain experiences, or they create certain experiences to you. So let's say a certain type of music creates in you the experience of tranquility. If I was looking at your white cells in the test tube, I'd find that your white cells make diazepam, which is Valium. You actually transform the music and metabolize it into your body making Valium, which is diazepam. In the body is actually an immunomodulator. It tells the immune cell, there's no hurry, take it easy. You can do a good job if you're calm and you're settled. You don't need to be jittery. And when you're jittery, then your immune cells make adrenaline. Even your platelets make adrenaline. And the body's inner intelligence knows what the right amount is, the right dose. If you create music that creates exhilaration, Vivaldi or something, and you feel exhilarated, your body secretes imipramine. Your immune cells secrete an antidepressant. So all sounds get metabolized into physiological responses. Okay, so mantra, chanting, music. In Ayurveda, we have what is called Gandharva Veda music, which is music that will take the seasons into account and take in the body's rhythm. So, vata balancing music, pitta balancing music, kapha balancing music. Now we're working with musicians to create the equivalent of vata, pitta and kapha balancing music, which uses Western melodies. So that's sound. Second experience, touch. We want to cover a lot of material, so I'm going to move right into touch. Skin is the biggest pharmacy in the body. The body is a huge pharmacy, but the skin is the biggest pharmacy in the body because it has so much surface area, and the skin is derived from the same germ layer as the brain. It's called the neuroectoderm. So all the different neuropeptides that are found in the brain, which are also, you know, the physical expression of our emotions, the same neuropeptides are also found in the skin. And some of the more significant neuropeptides, I've already mentioned a couple, imipramine, interleukins, interferons. There's a neuropeptide found in the skin which is very interesting. It's called vasoactive intestinal polypeptide, VIP. Very important peptide. The reason it's called vasoactive intestinal polypeptide is that originally it was discovered in the intestine. But it's actually found in the skin. It's also found in the brain. Now, VIP happens to be the most potent vasodilator known biologically. A vasodilator is something that opens up blood vessels. And VIP particularly improves coronary blood flow. There are very few studies on this, but they're very exciting. There is one study that shows that if you give somebody a massage with sesame oil, then the level of VIP increases about 3 to 5 fold in your blood and remains elevated for up to 3 weeks after a massage. And if you do a PET scan on someone, a PET scan is a positron emission tomography of the heart, immediately following an Ayurvedic massage, then as the VIP goes up, the coronary blood flow also increases, and about 15 to 25% increase in blood flow to the heart after an Ayurvedic massage. Simultaneously, the VIP level is going up. Now imagine you had a drug that did that and you didn't use it. After a heart attack, you would probably be sued for malpractice. So as we gather more data, my hope is that in every coronary care unit, people will be getting massages. We do more for them than a lot of the drugs that we use. Increases blood flow. Now, there's another very interesting thing that has been found by Candice Pert, who is a molecular biologist and a neuroendocrinologist. She was the chief of brain chemistry at one time at the NIH, till she made the following discovery. And the discovery was that VIP occupies the same receptor site on T cells as HIV. When a virus or anything needs to get inside a cell, it first has to go through a receptor on the cell wall. Just like if you want to enter a room that's locked, you need a key to open the door. So think of the peptide as a key and the lock as the receptor. You open the door and then you can get into the room. Now that's how HIV gets inside the cell, or that's how any peptide works. Now it so happens that VIP occupies the same receptor site as HIV. So theoretically, if there's a lot of VIP floating in your system, occupying all these receptor sites, then HIV cannot get inside the cell. And if it can't get inside the cell in vitro, in the test tube, it has a lifespan only for about 3 hours. Now when Candice made this discovery, she got so excited that she left the NIH because she thought, you know, the rigmarole and the bureaucracy of the government take her years and years to do what she wanted to. She wanted to understand more about the dynamics of peptides and how they occupy receptor sites, particularly in HIV disease. And she was ultimately able to not only identify this peptide, VIP, synthesize it, and she called it peptide T, is her name for it, because it occupies T cells, receptor sites. And in fact, right now, even as we speak, there are trials going on in Europe with peptide T as the next generation of drugs that will be used for treating HIV. And there are certain trials already that show that improves dementia, improves the neuropathy that's associated with HIV, improves many, many things. And these are very preliminary trials. The remarkable thing is it's a whole new concept. Every other treatment of HIV has been about killing the virus. You know, and whenever you use a chemotherapeutic agent, you kill the virus, of course, but you also kill normal cells. What this is doing is just telling the virus, I'm not going to let you in. That's all. And therefore, it's totally free of side effects. Totally free. But whilst all that is happening, I think just looking at this data, it's very important that everybody who has HIV infection or HIV, they should be getting a massage every day. They should be giving themselves a massage every day. Then there are, of course, antidepressants secreted. That's why you feel good after massage. I think anybody with any chronic illness, cancer, heart disease, arthritis, has immense benefit from massage because of the stimulation of this endogenous pharmacy that we've been speaking about. Any patient with any chronic illness, there's huge benefits from massage. We're only now beginning to understand how that massage is given, why sesame oil, what are the herbs used. This is part of another discussion which you will get, because the herbs that are used, there are some powerful antioxidant properties in these. They get absorbed into the system. They are free radical scavengers. They get rid of the toxins. So there's many mechanisms by which massage works. There's also the secretion of growth factors and growth hormone through massage. Growth hormone in children makes the children grow. But in adults, growth hormone is an anabolic hormone which has anti-aging effects. So people who get massage regularly or give themselves massage every day, their biological age can be measured. And you'll definitely see a difference. Even after 1 week of panchakarma, you'll see a difference in biological markers of aging. One of the reasons is there's secretion of growth factors and anabolic hormones in the system. So those are the benefits of the second experience, touch. This Ayurvedic knowledge helps us in many ways. And one of those is the whole notion that if we can introduce a vibrational sound in our body that resonates in all the cells of our body, that will facilitate or improve what we call entrainment, this falling into a rhythmic relationship with. Let me give you some examples of what are called tonal or vibrational sounds. These are sounds that vibrate in all the cells of the body. Traditionally, these are all the sounds of all the alphabets in all the languages. All the universe languages have more or less the same sounds to the alphabets. And if you take the vowels of these alphabets, the vowels are vibrational sounds. So let me give you an example of that. Ah, that's the sound of a vowel. Or a, or e, any of the vowels. Just take a deep breath, and then as you exhale, you make the sound of the vowel. And in English, of course, the vowels are A, E, I, O, U. So any of those vowels can be used to immediately cause a vibration in all the cells of our body. And when we do that, then what we do is we literally shake the cells, and as a result of vibrating the cells, they begin to entrain with each other, and they begin to train with other rhythms. So that's a way of restoring biological rhythm. There are other sounds, which are also sounds from the alphabet, that resonate in different parts of the body. The sound hum, for example, resonates mainly in the lungs. And again, the way you make it is you take a deep breath. Hum. That sound resonates in the lungs. It also resonates in the sinuses. It also resonates in the skull. The sound na, which is the sound of N, resonates in the eardrums. So again, what you do is you touch the back of your front teeth with your tongue, and then you make the sound of N, the alphabet N. So it's something like this. When you do that, you should be able to feel the resonance in the ears. This sound is used as a healing sound for people who have even mild degrees of deafness or tinnitus, which is ringing in the ears, or in fact just to cause that resonance in the ears to sharpen one's sense of hearing. The sound ma, which is the sound of M, which is the alphabet M, resonates mainly in the sinus cavities. So or ma ma ma. This sound resonates in the sinus cavities and therefore is very useful for people who are more prone to sinus infections or sinus headaches. The sound of Y, which is the letter Y I'm talking about, ya, you, ye, it mainly moves the temporomandibular joints. Ya, you, ye. As you make that sound, your jaw moves, this joint moves. And as a result, this is very useful for people who have, for example, headaches or migraine from what is known as temporomandibular joint disease. It's a common syndrome that occurs in Vata types. When they are very hyper, anxious, nervous, they tend to clench their teeth. So using this sound, ya, you, ye, loosens this joint. And not only will it loosen the joint, it will get rid of the headache, but more important, it will even get rid of the tension that comes, because the tension creates the tightness then reinforces the tension. So if you release the tension, then the tightness gets released, and if you release the tightness, the tension gets released. The sound of laughter, which is the sound ha, it's very good for people who have indigestion, or people who are experiencing heartburn, or people who have an abnormal appetite, for example, they don't get hungry frequently enough, or they get too hungry. The sound is the sound of the letter H, and it bounces off the stomach. So, ha, 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 the sound of laughter. And in fact, if you make that sound frequently enough, then you'll even experience the emotion of laughter. Because what's an emotion? An emotion is a thought that is coupled to a physical sensation. And if you evoke the physical sensation, then the thought also comes. If you have the thought, that evokes the physical sensation. So when you join the two, you can evoke the appropriate emotion. So if you just take a deep breath and say, ha, 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 and bounce the sound off your stomach,
you will experience the emotion of laughter. Now we know that when people experience emotions such as laughter, genuine laughter, then they make very powerful chemical messengers. In fact, the neuropeptides of laughter are very healing compounds. Dr. Norman Cousins has shown that laughter could be a very appropriate medicine for a number of diseases. Well, laughter as an emotion, but laughter as a sound also, has the ability to generate these peptides in the body. So I've given you quite a few examples of how we can use sound not only to begin entrainment, but we can use sound to bring about resonance in different parts of the body. And if we use all these sounds, we can see that we can entrain our body as a whole, also bring about vibrational changes and therefore the appropriate chemical changes in specific parts of the body. What you do is, you take a deep breath and then as you're exhaling, you make the appropriate sound till you run out of breath. And then as you run out of breath, you take a deep breath again. And then you repeat the whole sequence. So with each sound, you could do it, say, 3 times. And if you did all the sounds, it would take you about maybe 2-3 minutes. And you would have refreshed your whole body through vibration. So you could take a deep breath, and you could just make the sound, ya, you, ye, on the exhalation. You could do that 3 times. Then you could switch to the sound, na. Or you could take all the vowels, A, E, I, O, U, and then the sound ma or ma, ma. So all these sounds, and in fact, in the printed material included with these tapes is a list of all the sounds that one can use and also instructions on how you can use those sounds to resonate in different parts of the body and also what the sounds are useful for. If once we have an intellectual understanding that sound is used to create entrainment and restore a disrupted biological rhythm. I would recommend that you take each of the sounds provided on the list and once a day for about 5 minutes practice the whole series starting with the first, ending with the last. You take a deep breath and practice sounding out each one of those sounds about 3 times on the outgoing breath. If you practice these sounds regularly, and the whole procedure shouldn't take more than 3 or 4 minutes, you will experience the following changes in your physiology. Your sense of hearing will improve because there is a sound there to resonate against the eardrum inside the ear. Your digestion will improve as a result of the vowel sounds resonating in all the parts of the body. You will experience much more energy and you'll feel less fatigue. And then, of course, one can use specific sounds to get rid of a headache or get rid of a nervous stomach, etc. Incidentally, all of these procedures also are very useful breathing exercises, because what you're doing is, as you take in a deep breath, then you're practicing the sound on the outgoing breath, and then you sound it out for as long as you can, and then you're forced to take a deep breath again. And therefore, the sounds open up the lungs at the same time as they improve your physiology. So they're opening up the lungs, providing increased oxygen to your body, and so on. So you feel the sense of energy and renewal just as a result of making those sounds. So this is one technique of using sound. But of course, one can also listen to music. And any music that evokes a playful, happy mood or increases a sense of buoyancy is healing music. Now, of course, traditionally in Ayurveda, there are certain frequencies that are used to balance the body's rhythms at certain times of the day. However, any music that creates that feeling of buoyancy, that feeling of cheerfulness, will create the appropriate chemical responses in the body. A little bit of music every day, listening to a little bit of music, is very refreshing and very renewing. There's research now that shows that if you listen to some sad music, say Beethoven's Funeral March, and if you listen to it long enough, then your cells start behaving as if they're going to a funeral. They start literally responding to that at the cellular level. Or if you listen to rock music, the cells become quite jittery sometimes. Of course, that may be appropriate for short periods, but over a long period, it can be quite disruptive. Classical music always results in very smooth biological functioning and the appropriate release of chemicals that are healing. So listening to music, or making the appropriate sounds, or listening to internal sounds. There's one other way you can listen to sounds. It may sound a little esoteric, but it has a scientific basis to it. You gently occlude the ears with your forefinger. So you just very gently occlude the ear canals with your forefinger, close the eyes, and just have a receptive listening attitude. And then you may be able to hear from your own awareness, from inside you, certain sounds. At times it can sound like the ringing of bells, or at other times it can sound like music. At other times there are screeching sounds, other times there are sounds like ocean waves. It's a good monitor of how your health is, because if your health is good, the sounds that come out from inside are very pleasant sounds. If your health is not good, the sounds that come out from inside are disruptive sounds. In fact, instruments are now being developed that can amplify the sounds each organ of the body makes. Then you can amplify that, and you'll find when there's a certain disease, then the sound is disrupted. There's a distortion in the natural sound that's coming. Playing the appropriate sound back to the organ will restore that distortion. So listening to the internal sounds that are generated inside our body by gently occluding the ear canals with your forefinger and just having that quiet receptive attitude will improve one's sense of hearing also. So these are some of the techniques that one can use to not only experience better sensory perception through sound, but also use sound for healing. And traditionally, in all cultures all over the world, sound has been used for healing. And they use the same sounds, because the sounds are basically universal sounds. They form the alphabets of all the different languages. Our bodies are constantly bombarded from the environment through sound. So frequently we talk about pollution, but we fail to recognize that sound pollution is one of the important factors in inducing discomfort and also ultimately disease. For example, it's well known that loud noise amplifies aggression and can cause premature deafness and interferes with learning ability. Martial music has been traditionally used through centuries to make people go to war. So there are sounds that can evoke a host of emotional responses. And one can use the sounds to then get rid of the inappropriate emotions as well. And therefore, sound becomes a very important therapeutic tool in healing. Okay, I want to move on to the third experience, which is the experience of sight, color, vision. First of all, what's a chakra? How do you explain a chakra to anyone? The best way to explain it in scientific terms is it's the junction point where energy and matter come together in very high concentration. Energy and matter and consciousness. The three things we spoke about, information, energy, and matter, come together. Of course, in every part of the body, there's this link between information, energy, and matter. But it so happens that in the chakras, this link is much more concentrated. And in Vedic theory, chakras, amongst other things that they do, they control biological activities. So the root chakra, if it's a problem with the root chakra, then the problems are with elimination, bowels, constipation, irritable bowel, things like that. If there's a problem with the second chakra, the place where Freud got stuck, that place, then you have reproductive problems, you know, problems with infertility,
impotence, things like that. If you have problems with the third chakra, which is in the solar plexus, you have problems like ulcers and stomach problems, indigestion, heart chakra, obviously heart disease, throat chakra, you have thyroid problems, you have problems in the neck, those kinds of things. In the third eye, which is over here, that chakra, you have problems with cognitive function, and with the crown chakra, which is here, if there's a problem there, then you have a problem with life. It's the basic, it's the, what is called, enlightenment deficiency. So, so the colors that are associated with the chakras, they're the colors of the spectrum, of the visible spectrum. So the meditation that is practiced is very simple. You just, before you do your primordial sound meditation or you do your breathing meditation, just for a few minutes, so all you do is you sit quietly, put your attention on the chakra and visualize the corresponding color, which is to balance that chakra. And of course, if you want, then you can do the mantra sound of the chakra. So the root chakra, the sound, David probably went over this with you. Lam, Vam, Ram, Yam, Ham, Ksham, and Om. As you're thinking the sound, the mantra, you're also visualizing the color. It's a very traditional, classic way of balancing the chakras. The next sensory experience is the experience of taste. Ayurveda recognizes six tastes. And these six tastes are sweet, sour, salt, bitter, pungent, astringent. Sweet, sour, salt, bitter, pungent, and astringent. All complex carbohydrates and anything that has a sweet taste or an after taste that's sweet, including fish, fowl, and meat, is sweet. Any complex carbohydrate, anything that has a sweet taste or an aftertaste, fruits that are sweet are in that category. Salt needs no explanation. Everybody knows what that tastes like. Sour, dominantly things like yogurt, cheese, salad dressings, these are all sour tastes. Vinegar. Bitter, all green leafy vegetables classified as bitter. But particularly some that are actually quite bitter, like some types of spinach, like fenugreek. There's an Indian plant called neem, which is extremely bitter. But generally, all green leafy, cabbage, spinach, fenugreek. Astringent, all beans and lentils and pulses, dal, is astringent. Tea is astringent. Coffee is astringent and bitter. Pungent. Anything that has pungency or spice to it. So all spices, black pepper, red pepper, jalapenos, serrano, mustard, horseradish, ginger, garlic, pungent taste. So those are the six tastes. And each taste elicits a different physiological response in the body. The effect of taste, the after effect of taste, the virya, the vipak, the post-digestive effect. But for tonight, just remember three things. Sweet, sour, and salt, that combination balances vata. Slows down your metabolism. Bitter, pungent, and astringent balances kapha, speeds up your metabolism. Astringent, bitter, sweet balances pitta, reduces inflammation. And when we are talking about this, we are talking about physical body and subtle body, both. So it influences both the emotions as well as the physiological responses. Finally, let's talk for a few seconds about smell. The smell receptors that we have in our nose, in the back of our nose, are actually olfactory bulbs. They're neurons. They're direct extensions of our hypothalamus, which is linked to the limbic system. And the limbic system, as I mentioned to you yesterday, is the brain's brain. It controls autonomic responses. Autonomic responses are those things happening in the body for which we don't have any conscious control. So what are those things? Well, breathing is one. We don't consciously breathe all the time, although we can if we want to. The sleep-wake cycle is another. Body temperature regulation is another. Regulation of heart rate and blood pressure is another. So these are some of the very obvious things that are being taken care of by a part of our nervous system without our having to pay any attention to it. That's autonomic function. Now it so happens that autonomic function, memory, smell, and behavior are very intimately linked to each other. And there's some very interesting information about smell and pheromones. Pheromones are these very subtle hormones secreted in very small quantities by our body in response to our emotions, and they're secreted in our skin and in our breath and in our urine, in all our secretions, in our saliva. And these hormones correspond to different emotional states. And scientists who are working on these hormones, they are finding that every emotion has a pheromone and an odor associated with it. So when you say, I smell danger, you might be actually speaking the literal truth. There's a smell associated with that experience. And you know, this classic study that first came from Stanford, where they took mice and they would give them electrical shocks, and then they remove the mice from the room. Other mice are brought into the room. As soon as these other mice come into the room, they panic. They start releasing adrenaline and cortisol and all the stress hormones. And the explanation is they're breathing the hormones of fear left behind by the mice that were given the electrical shocks. So now when you say, I went into this room and I felt really tense, the reason is you're breathing the hormones of anxiety by the people who were there. Or who are there. So pheromones is a new area of study. But just remember that every emotion has a hormone associated and an odor. When somebody is angry, there's an odor associated with that anger. When somebody is sexually excited, there's an odor associated with that. When somebody is passionate about something, there's an odor associated. And that's part of our nose here. There's a thing called the vomeronasal gland that picks that up, even below the level of our conscious awareness. And that then, in fact, it's triggered by memory, or memory is triggered by smell. Bonding is through smell, between parent and child, between siblings. You know, in a big family, if you have lots of children, you'll find that if the siblings are bonded, then they can identify whose undershirt it is by smelling it. Because every undershirt has its own characteristic odor. It's that person's personality. It's their whole complex being in that odor. Lovers know that, and people who are bonded know that. Mothers and children know that. Animals know that. They bond through that. So, I think everyone also knows that a smell will trigger a very powerful physiological response as well as a powerful memory at the same time. And sometimes an urge to do something. And there's neuroassociative conditioning with that. And many years ago, what I had is, over here, when I was in Lancaster, I had an interesting incident. There was a four-year-old boy who actually came from a family in San Diego. And this boy had a condition called Wilms tumor, kidney cancer. And in his particular case, the Wilms tumor was responding to chemotherapy. The only problem was that every time he got his chemotherapy, he would go into dehydration. He'd had intense nausea and vomiting. And you know, they'd take him to this chemotherapeutic unit here in San Diego, some hospital, all these doctors dressed in white uniforms with serious looking expressions, the smell of antiseptic, and they give him his chemotherapy, they hold him there, he starts to vomit and
starts to go into dehydration. So those days I used to be in Massachusetts, and they told me about this, and I invited them to bring the boy to Massachusetts, and I said, let's try something. And what I did was, I just had this boy surrounded by loving therapists, that nourishment, that nourishing energy. And then we introduced sensory modulation, music and games and colors, and just total stimulation through the five senses. And while that was going on, you'd give him his little chemotherapy, he wouldn't even know it. And his tumor would start to shrink, and no side effects. Which is one thing, by the way, in cancer, sensory modulation is great. If somebody is getting chemotherapy and they have to, and you know, in many cases, chemotherapy really helps, use sensory modulation. You can eliminate side effects. Eliminate. It's very interesting. A lot of side effects to chemotherapy are neuroassociative condition responses. Do you know that some patients will have a drop in their white count and their platelet count as they drive to their chemotherapy unit, before they get the chemotherapy? Their white count and their platelet count will drop because of the neuroassociative conditioning that they've had by going there. You can modify that through sensory modulation, which is what I did with this boy, 4 years of age. Well, one day, for some reason, that place where we used to play all these tricks with him and have fun, we couldn't do it, so we had to take him to a different part of the building, and we took him through an elevator, and as soon as he went through the elevator, he started having nausea, vomiting, he dehydrated. And we had no idea what had happened, and then we all got together and we realized that the smell in the elevator happened to have disinfectant, which was similar to the smell in the San Diego chemotherapeutic unit. All we had to do is change the smell, and again, he was fine. So that's how powerful neuroassociative conditioning is. Memories, behaviors, physiological responses. So smell, therefore, can be used to really create balance and to elicit physiological responses. I gave you one example of that through neuroassociative. You know, you produce the sound, you at the same time have a certain smell associated with it. Okay, in conclusion, these are the smells that have different effects. In general, all floral and fruity essences are vata balancing. Anything that comes from a fruit or comes from a flower usually is vata balancing. In general, anything that has a cooling effect, obviously, is pitta balancing. Sandalwood, rose, mint, jasmine, these are cooling smells. And anything that is aromatic and spicy is stimulating, is kapha balancing. And as you learn more about the different diseases that are associated with the different doshas, then we'll be able to use smell in a very intelligent way through neuroassociative conditioning. So sensory modulation is never isolated. You combine all this to influence the pharmacy that's within. When we look around us, we see that everything is recycled elements, recycled space, air, fire, water, and earth. Our physical body is that. It's all a manifestation of consciousness. So, if this is not hopelessly abstract, then I can proceed a little further. These combinations of the five elements, as consciousness is moving within itself and unfolding as sound, touch, sight, taste, and smell, these create certain types of principles. Space and air creates the principle of movement, because that's what happens. There's a lot of room for movement in space and air. This principle in Ayurveda is called Vata, V-A-T-A. Water and fire creates the principle of transformation or metabolism. When you're cooking, what do you need? Water and fire. Transformation. Metabolism. Conversion. This principle of transformation is called Pitta, P-I-T-T-A. And earth and water, the last two elements,
face the principle of stability, solidity, structure. And this principle is called Kapha, K-A-P-H-A. So once again, space and air create the principle of movement, known as Vata. Water and fire create the principle of transformation, known as Pitta. Earth and water create the principle of stability or structure or solidity, known as Kapha. These are the three basic principles that are operating in the intelligence of nature. You see movement, you see transformation, and you see structure. These principles operate in our bodies. They operate in a tree, in a plant, in galaxies, in our mind, in a corporate structure. Anything that has organization, you'll find this. The principle of movement, the principle of transformation, and the principle of structure or solidity. So if these principles are well understood, we can see how nature functions. If the first two principles dominate our awareness, and the first two principles are space and air. If they dominate our awareness, then that awareness is dominated by movement. A vata, body therefore. And that could be referring to the body of a tree or a plant or a human being. But let's think of it in human terms. If you have a vata principle dominating your awareness, which means space and air, then that kind of person is hyper-metabolic because movement is dominating. And metabolism is dominated by movement. So this is the kind of person who's hyper-metabolic. In general, their metabolism is in the fast lane. There's the kind of person who says, I can eat anything I want and I never gain weight. If you look at them, these people are thin. They are ectomorphic. Ectomorphic, their skin and their bones dominate their physiology. They have sharp angular features. Nice curved nose with a nice point at the end. If you look at their bones, you can see bony prominences. You can see tendons. Of course, the skin is dry and cool because space and air, dry and cool. They have hyperactive reflexes. If you tap their knee, boom, boom, like that. Quick. Everything is in the fast lane. They think fast. They process information fast. They move quickly. They may frequently change their job or their relationships. So these are Vata people. Psychologically, their psychological traits mirror their hypermetabolic activity. They are friendly, they are vivacious, they are enthusiastic, they are exhilarating to be with. That's under normal circumstances. But if they get stressed, and what's stress? Stress is the physical or psychological perception of threat. It's the perception of physical or psychological threat. Or you might say in Ayurvedic terms, stress is that which interferes with the spontaneous flow of intelligence as it moves from unmanifest to manifest. As it moves from the field of pure potentiality, pure creativity, to the field of matter and energy. Anything that interferes with that spontaneity of intelligence, moving from unmanifest to manifest. If a Vata person gets stressed, then those hyper-metabolic traits, they are reflected in the following symptoms. These people get insomnia, they get anxiety, they get cold intolerance, they get constipation, sometimes diarrhea. They get muscle aches and pains. They get menstrual cramps. They get migraine headaches. Or one or another of these symptoms. So, how many people listening to this description think that they may be in this category? Could you please stand up? so we can look at you. Okay. So all these people shared the traits that I just spoke about. They have a hypermetabolic tendency. And under normal circumstances, they're just the most exhilarating people to be with. But under stress, you can see what types of situations they may encounter. Okay, thank you. Now the second category of person is the Pitta body type. The Pitta body type, where the two characteristics are what? Fire and water. So, like the Vata was cool and dry, here fire and water, warm and moist. These people, their skin is warm and moist, but they now have a little more mesomorphic tendency. They're more muscular. They're more athletic. They're more articulate, more disciplined, more precise, more fiery, more passionate, more hardy. And if you look at them, the muscle dominates more than skin and bones. Under normal circumstances, as I said, disciplined, precise, hardy, passionate, articulate, all of those. But get them under stress, and stress is that which interferes with the manifestation of intelligence from unmanifest to manifest. And under stress, what happens? They get angry. They get impatient. They get jealous. They are the type A's. They start getting heartburn and ulcers. They get hypertension. They may be more prone to heart attacks. Their skin breaks out, inflammatory kinds of expressions. They may get inflammatory arthritis, which is rheumatoid arthritis. Vata people never get rheumatoid arthritis. If they get arthritis, it's osteoarthritis. So now you see the second category of people. And how many people listening to this description can recognize themselves? Would you please stand up? All the Pitta people in this audience. Okay, thanks. And then the last category is those people who have the elements earth and water dominating. Earth and water. These people are more endomorphic. The first person was skin and bones more proportionately. The second category, muscle more proportionately. The third person, fat more proportionately. Now that doesn't mean that they're obese. It just is that they have a nice cushion of fat under their skin. So usually you can't see their bones so clearly. You can't see their tendons so clearly. They don't have these sharp angular features. They're a little more rounded. And their metabolism is slower. The first one, metabolism was very fast. The second one, metabolism is fiery. The third one, metabolism is easygoing. They're the kind of people who say, all I have to do is look at food and I start to gain weight. If you examine their skin, you'll find that it's cool because earth and water are cool and it's moist. It's a little bit moist. Their reflexes are a little bit slow. They walk very leisurely. The Vata people walk very fast. You know, the Kapha people walk leisurely. They speak leisurely. They're not easily ruffled. They're easygoing and placid. They're calm. They're sympathetic. They're empathetic. They have a nice sense of humor. They're very loving. They're very gracious. When you get them under stress, then what does earth and water do? It holds on to everything. So they hold on to fat. They hold on to fluid. They hold on to relationships. They hold on to money. They hold on to their possessions. And the kinds of things they get into problems with is they get obesity, they get sinus congestion, they get chest congestion, they get allergies, they get fluid retention in their knees, in their feet, and they're more prone to diabetes, they're more prone to high cholesterol, etc. but principally congestive states, because they're holding on to food and fat and fluid. How many people listening to this description see themselves as kapha? Me too. Okay. So now, of course, nobody's really all vata or all pitta or all kapha. In your handouts, you have tests. You can answer questions, and you'll find that one dominates, and then there's another one that comes pretty close, maybe even within 10 points of that. And then you can be a combination. But having listened to this description, how many people have absolutely no idea what category they belong in? Would you please stand up? Now, all these people we should regard as vata, because confusion is a vata state. Okay? But they're totally confused, treat it as a vata disorder. So now everybody knows what they are. Okay, so this is how the body types are arrived at. You might want to do the test and see where you fit in. And you'll find that you are either a dominant vata, dominant pitta, a dominant kapha, and that, in fact, there may be a combination, that there may be two that are pretty close. And that's okay. So you can be a vata pitta, you can be a vata kapha, or you can be a pitta vata, or a pitta kapha, or a vata pitta kapha, or just vata, or just pitta kapha. There are approximately 10 different body types. So is it possible, or would you want to change your body type? First of all, it's not possible to change your body type. And secondly, you wouldn't want to. In fact, you have chosen your body type through your karmic software. You know, like everything else, we choose even the body type through which we want to express ourselves. The main thing is to make sure that that body type is in a state of balance. Because it isn't, you know, vata is not better than pitta, and pitta is not better than kapha. There's no hierarchy here. They're all different manifestations of nature, and when they are in balance, each of these are wonderful to be with. The vata is exhilarating and vivacious and lively and enthusiastic. The pitta is passionate and articulate and courageous and chivalrous. The kapha is loving and compassionate and empathetic and has a great sense of humor. So they're all wonderful. It's only when you get into stress that you see the problems. Incidentally, recently, there's a lot been said about control dramas that we play when we are under stress. So the control drama of the vata is fickleness, unreliability. The control drama of the pitta is anger, confrontation, intimidation. The control drama of kapha is withdrawal, stubbornness, indifference. The absence of all control dramas is love. But we don't really need to get into that in great detail. Right now, I think the main thing to understand, what's my dominant? What's my dominant dosha, it's called. The word dosha means body type. It's not just a body type, it's a psychophysiological body type. It gives you an idea of what you look like, how you behave, and how you think. Really gives you a clue to all these things. Not only your appearance, but your behavior and your thoughts and the kinds of things that you're prone to when you're under stress. Many years ago, I was taking a flight from Chicago, actually, to a little town in Iowa, and happened to be in the middle of winter. And at the last minute, because of a major snowstorm, they canceled the flight. And you should have seen what happened. All the vata people were at another counter, making other arrangements, calling up on the phone, changing their reservations, etc. The pitta people were screaming at this woman who made the announcement. How dare she cancel the flight? And the kapha people were gently sauntering off to the ice cream parlor. Okay? So, And then we say we are free. We think we are free. We are not. We are bundles of conditioned reflexes. And we are triggered by circumstances and people into totally predictable outcomes. An announcement in the middle of a snowstorm, and you can predict what's going to happen. So three people get stuck in a traffic jam. One may get anxiety and claustrophobia. Another may get angry and impatient. A third may tune into Mozart. Okay? They're just reacting to themselves. Whenever you react to anybody, any situation, any circumstance, doesn't matter what that is, the rainy weather, traffic jam, snowstorm, criticism from your boss, love letter, you're not reacting to somebody out there or something out there. You're reacting to yourself. Every time we react to anything, we are reacting to ourselves. And in fact, we are reacting in a very predictable way. Once you begin to understand yourself, you know exactly how you'll react in certain situations, circumstances, with certain people, and with certain things. And therefore, the main idea to do this kind of body typing is not to say, well, I'm in this category, pigeonhole me in this category. Because nobody can be pigeonholed, we're all unique. But we have certain tendencies. And as long as we get in touch with our tendencies, then we'll be better able to nourish ourselves. We'll be better able to understand ourselves. That's what it's about. Because as we understand ourselves, we'll understand other people as well. All relationship is a mirror. We are attracted to those people in which we seek something that will complement what we don't have or what we want more of. And we are repelled by those people in whom we see traits that we are actually denying in ourselves. So when we understand the mirror of relationship and how all this works, it allows us to function in a more harmonious manner. We allow the harmonious interaction of all the elements and forces that make this a very exquisite and a very interesting dance. And this is the dance of life.